appreciate you being here tonight. We have a good crowd. Philip is not here. He's not feeling well. So please remember him. And I hear we have somebody in the class who had a birthday today. Is that right?
Yesterday.
Well, that's close enough. Happy birthday. Glad to see everybody here. We are on page 9 in your notebook. We'll give everybody a chance to get your notebook and find that. And let's begin with a prayer together. Father, for this day we offer thanks. You have blessed us richly, and we appreciate that so much. Thank you for the opportunity to be here to study together, to open our minds as we think about how to be good teachers, how to have a good educational program in our churches. Bless us as we study. We pray through Christ. Amen. I will make another announcement that Mark Day will be your teacher next week. I will be in a meeting in Lancaster, Kentucky. Anybody know where Lancaster is? It's on Route 27 down out of Lexington. It was the last place my father preached before he retired. He was there 26 years and retired in his 80s. And I'm going back to that church, and it's going to be, I think, a very good meeting, a lot of fun, but very emotional, too, to go back to that congregation he loved so much and that loved him so much. Mark said, and I quote, "The only problem is that he does not have as many antidotes as I have." Well, it's all right. If he can use mine, I'll fill him in on some that I would normally use in that lesson. I will tell you all the things I would normally say. But when you get to be 66 and you've done this for 48 years, you'll have lots of stories to tell. And you'll bore people just like I do with the stories. I hope you understand and are seeing that the lessons actually tie together, that one is built on the other. We began with the importance of the educational program. If we don't think it's important, then there's no sense in having a class like this. I don't want us to study a matter that's unimportant. So we began with, why is it important? Then we asked the question, why do we have Bible classes anyway? And then we asked the question, okay, why do I need to be involved in the Bible classes? Why do I need to be a teacher? And I made the point last week that I think we really need to challenge people to aspire to be and to plan to be and to train to be teachers. I think we've asked them, do you want to be a teacher? And that's not quite the same as inspiring them to want to be. And we do that in large part by telling them the advantages. We preach the disadvantages. We preach the problems. Here's the downside. Here's the negatives. And we need to tell people that there is a tremendous advantage, blessing, to being a teacher. So on the heels of that, we ask tonight, okay, so I ought to be a teacher. What kind of teacher should I be? If I need to be a teacher, if I should be a teacher, what kind of teacher should I aspire to be? There are three kinds of teachers, you'll notice in the second slide at the bottom of page 9. There are, first of all, teachers who are never remembered. I suspect that you've had some of those in school, in church. It's Miss So-and-so, she taught, what was her name? You know, she was, and it just, the teacher was there, but they really didn't impact our lives. It's not somebody we would tell a nice story about. They were just there. Now, frankly, folks, I hate to admit this, but I've had some of those teachers in Bible school that I know they taught, but they didn't really leave a whole lot of an impression on me. They were just kind of nondescript, They were there. Secondly, there are teachers who are never forgiven. Do you have one of those? Here's one of my stories, Mark.
These are rich.
No, these are good. I was a senior at good old Cerrito Canova High School, and I had taken all of the coursework I needed, but then they wouldn't let you go home. Okay? Now you can just go home, but we had a closed campus and we had to stay there. And so I took gym, phys ed, and I took typing. Now, I'm really thankful I took typing since I type every day. And I sat in the principal's office all afternoon. I was student body president, and I signed hall passes. I thought it was really big stuff, you know. I'd sign all the hall passes for all the kids. Had to go someplace between classrooms. And the coach in the phys ed class was not being renewed for the next year, and he just went on a tear. I mean, he wasn't a happy camper, and he let us know he wasn't a happy camper, and we weren't happy campers either. And one day as we were coming out of the shower, he was there with the paddle. And he paddled everybody. Now, you know how you come out of the shower. And you're wet and fairly unclothed, I would think. And somebody to stand there with a big, long paddle and paddle you is not a whole lot of fun. And so we asked him, why did you do that, coach? He said, well, somebody down here was making a lot of noise, and I figured if I paddled everybody, I'd get the right one. You know what that's called in these days? Lawsuit. That's called lawsuit, yes. But then it was like, okay, that's kind of what happened in school. I have not forgotten that guy. I marked him off my Christmas card list. I don't go to visit him. You have a hard time with somebody who you feel like did something that was just absolutely wrong. Do you know that that can happen in a Bible class? It really can. You can be embarrassed. Maybe you're a poor reader, and the teacher insists that you read the next verse. And it's a part of the genealogy in Matthew 1 or something, you know. And it's like, you don't know what that's about. You don't know those words, but the teacher said, you read. You sit up there and read. I'll talk to your parents if you don't. And that's just embarrassing. So there are teachers that we have a hard time forgiving. We remember them, but not for good things. Then there are teachers who are never forgotten. These are the ones that you talked about last week. Remember when you had that little sheet that had the picture frame on it, and you did the word picture of the teacher that impacted you, with the exception of Philip, who remembered somebody who wasn't what they ought to be. Everybody else had glowing things. They were sweet and wonderful and loving and kind and all of these kinds of things. Now, it's a question that the answer's there, and I know what your answer is, but what kind do you want to be? Do you want to be a teacher who's never remembered? No, I don't think so. Do you want to be a teacher who's never forgiven? I don't think so. I think you want to be the teacher who is never forgotten and is appreciated, and years from now, somebody will introduce you. That was my teacher. I remember when I was in junior high class at church, and he was my teacher. I remember in the fifth and sixth grade class, she was my teacher. Boy, I loved her. Now, what would be the question that would follow then? How do I get to be that kind of teacher? What do I have to do to become that kind of teacher? Well, I'm going to say that we have to be teachers of character and integrity. Now, let's understand our terms. Character is an engraving tool and the mark it makes. As a matter of fact, if you can remember typewriters, who can remember typewriters? Now, some people, it's like computers, yeah, but typewriters, nah. That's almost like vinyl records, you know. They are no more. What did they call each little letter on your typewriter?
Character.
A character. So a character is either the tool or the mark it makes. as it strikes something. Now, what does it mean to be a person of character? It means we believe there are absolutes, that there is right and wrong behavior. Now, that's not very popular these days, is it? People argue that there are no absolutes, but what's the only thing that they're absolutely sure of? That there are no absolutes, which just absolutely fries my brain. You know, I just can't figure that out. They say there are no absolutes, and they're just absolutely sure about that, which seems to be a self-defeating argument. But if you're a person of character, you believe that there are absolutes. Now, can there be a little bit of a problem there with that? Say it again. It does not allow for a lot of flexibility, okay? Anything else as you see is a little problem? Your absolutes may be different from my absolutes, right? What will determine that?
Should have an objective standard.
Oh, we should have an objective standard. But often it's how we were reared, what we've come to believe. But really, we need to have an objective standard, that is the Bible, to help us know what is absolutely right and absolutely wrong. But there are some areas that fall in the cracks. Chuck and I were talking about one, and he was talking about a place where he went, and in some advertisement they had, the church had, there was instrumental music. And he was making the point that we argue against instrumental music, and then in this advertisement for Vacation Bible School, is that what it was? There was an instrument behind the advertising. And can you see that that might be an area where we would have all kinds of different opinions as to whether that violated the prohibition against instrumental music in worship? See, I maintain that what the New Testament says we ought not do is have the instrument in our worship. It doesn't forbid an instrument per se. It forbids that in our worship to God, in our corporate worship. So then we come to the question, does having it in some other form, in some other thing associated with the church, is that a violation? And then we come back to the argument, well, it looks bad, and it kind of undoes the argument that we make against it in worship. And all of those are matters of judgment, aren't they? Will we all agree on everything? I was telling him when I preached in Canton, the North Canton congregation was considered the most conservative of the churches of Christ in the area. And yet, for weddings, they would allow a piano in their building. The church that I preached for, which was the Market Avenue Church, was not considered the most conservative one in town, and we wouldn't. And I held several meetings in the North Canton building, in the North Canton building, because they would allow it for a wedding. Their argument was, it's not worship, and so we will allow it. Well, there's some room there for some judgment, is there not, in areas like that? And I think we must acquiesce to what the leaders of a local congregation decide in regard to matters like that. It may not be what some other leaders... By the way, here's a Tom Miller thing, and you just have to mark this down. We argue strongly for congregational autonomy, and it scares us to death to practice it. Now, you stop to think about that. Because if somebody dares do something in their congregation that we don't do in ours, it scares us to death, at least. I know a church in Knoxville that on Super Bowl evening rented a big screen TV, didn't have services, and had a Super Bowl party. One of our deacons came. Now, he was an alarmist anyway. I mean, he would just... Everything scared him to death. He came in, did you hear what they're going to do over there? And I said, no. What are they going to do? He said, they're not going to have services. They're going to watch a football game. What do you think about that? I said, I don't care. He said, what? I said, I don't care. He said, are you serious? I said, I am absolutely serious. I don't care. I don't know of a verse that tells us thou shalt have a service at 6 o'clock on Sunday evening anyway. I think that's a matter of congregational autonomy and the leadership deciding when they will meet or and when they will not meet. And it was none of my business what they were doing. I wasn't going to get involved in that. He just went away shaking his head and mumbling, thinking that I was just an absolute radical. Probably was, but it wasn't because of that. But there, a person of character says there are absolutes. And furthermore, he believes that we must accept the responsibility to do the right and avoid the wrong. So if I believe this is absolutely right, if I'm a person of character, what do I say?
Well, you've already decided within your mind what's right and what's wrong.
Well, but if I'm a person of character, what must I do as far as my standard is concerned?
Abide by it.
I must abide by it. When I don't abide by it, then I cease being
a person of character.
I have a dear friend whose father owned a bar. And in a little town in West Virginia called Hundred. Anybody ever hear of Hundred? Mm-hmm. It's a spot in the road. Not even a wide spot, it's just a very narrow spot. And his father owned a bar in town. But I never met a man that was any more staunch in his feeling of absolute right and absolute wrong than this fella. Now, his standard was not my standard. But he believed, first of all, if you were his friend, he'd do anything in the world for you. I mean, that was his standard, buddy. If you were his friend, it didn't matter what it was, he'd do it for you. It didn't even matter if it was right. It didn't even matter if it was legal. He just believed you're his friend. His standard said, I will stand by my friends, I will support my friends. Now, that was not my standard, that was his standard. So a person of character says, I believe there are rights, and I'll do them. I believe there are wrongs, and I will avoid them. Now, is there a difference between character and reputation?
Yes.
Character is what we are. What's reputation?
What we want people to think we are.
Well, it may not even be what we want them to think. It's what they think. It's their judgment. It's what they see. Was Jesus a person of character?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Was he a person of sterling reputation? No, he was not. As a matter of fact, what did they say about him? John came neither eating or drinking. And what did they say about him? Well, that's not what they said about John. It says he has an evil spirit. I mean, he's crazy. Jesus comes eating and drinking, and they say he's a gluttonous man and a wine bibber. Was he? But that was his reputation. So a reputation can be correct or incorrect. But character is what I really am in the dark when nobody's looking. Reputation is what others perceive me to be. Now, what's integrity? Integrity is adherence to a code of values. Now, here's how the two tie together. Character accepts the code, and integrity demands that I follow it. Might I have a code that I don't follow? Yes. Did you ever go to visit somebody who's not been attending services? And what's one of the first things they may say? Oh, I know I ought to be there. I really should. And what's the word that follows?
But
they've already told you what their code tells them. But now they're going to tell you that they're not a person of integrity to follow that code. Reminds me of the story of a boy who went away to college to learn agriculture. He went back to the little farming community where he grew up, and he started telling the farmers all about strip farming and proper means of putting nutrients back into the soil and fertilizer and all of that kind of stuff. And one of the old farmers said, oh, sonny, just you might as well shut up. We already ain't farming half as good as we know how. And it makes me think that there are a lot of us who aren't doing half as well as we know how to do. Integrity says, I will do as well as I know to do with God's help and with His strength. Job. What was the only thing that Job said he had not abandoned and still held on to?
His integrity.
And isn't it interesting, if you know the story of Job, he did not abandon his integrity. What did he start out saying? I didn't do anything wrong. What did his so-called friends tell him? You must have done something wrong if you just confess it. I mean, with friends like that, you hardly need enemies. I've always thought it was interesting. God took everything away from him except his wife. And I think he ought to have taken her too. She was a mess. That woman's the one who said, why don't you just curse God and die? What did Job hold on to? His integrity. He started saying, I didn't do anything wrong, and he ended up saying, I didn't do anything wrong. He never gave in. Yes.
I think you said that wrong. God didn't take it away from him. Satan took it away.
Well, okay,
from
you're
him.
Right. You're right. God allowed it. Yeah.
Some said Satan didn't take his wife because he was looking to punish him.
And all the men said amen, and the women looked at us over their glasses.
I'm telling your wife.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you're right. Satan did that, but God allowed him. God is sovereign. God allowed that to be done. But Satan was the one who actually did it. Integrity demands courage. Why does integrity always demand courage?
Sometimes it's hard to do what integrity requires.
That's exactly right. It's awfully hard sometimes to do what your code of values says you ought to do. It means you may lose some friends. It may mean that you may lose a job. It may mean lots of things. But we need all of us to be people of character and integrity. I think especially teachers need to be people of character and integrity. I said something last week, if you'll remember, that as important as what you say in the classroom is what you are in the classroom. What did you remember about the teachers that most impressed you? Was it a particular lesson they taught on a particular Sunday morning or Wednesday night? What was it?
What they were.
It was what they were. So when we're looking for teachers, as a matter of fact, I think when we're looking for elders or deacons or preachers or anything else, we look for what people are. Yes, sir.
Like Acts 1, where Jesus began
to do and to teach. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Now, let's talk about questions that we must ask ourselves in order to determine if we are people of character and integrity. Three questions. Number one, what's really most important to me? What tells the tale about you in that regard? What answers that question? Is there anything you can think of that will tell what's most important to you? Okay. Somebody said two things, a checkbook and a day timer. Do you believe that? A checkbook and a day timer will tell you what's most important to you. Now, what they're meaning is how you spend your money and how you spend your time. Is that true? We spend inordinate amounts of money on things that are important to us. You get a fella who has a hobby. I know a fella who is a fisherman, even participates in bass tournaments. If you look at his checkbook, where do you think a large part of his money goes? Boat, trailer, four-wheel drive to pull it, rods, reels. He'll spend more on a rod and reel than I'll spend, I started to say, on a car. That's probably not true, but I mean, he will spend hundreds of dollars for a rod and reel. I want a Zebco for 1995. You know, that's good enough for me, but not for him. And he'll go on a trip and spend 2 or 3 days out and stay in a motel and bear all that expense to fish. I think fishing's fun. But you know from how he spends his time and how he spends his money what's important to him. I think that our checkbooks and our day timers tell on us. Matthew 6:33, everybody knows that, don't you? But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added. What are these things? If you read back in the chapter, what are these things? Food, clothing, shelter. Pretty important, right? But not first. It's not wrong to think about clothes or food or shelter. It's wrong to think about those things as the most important things. Now, if we're going to be teachers, what must be obvious about us in regard to what's important to us? We seek the kingdom first. How will you tell that about people?
Where they are and what they're doing.
Okay. How they attend the services? How involved they are in the program of work? Will that tell us something about what's important to them? Okay. So we've got to ask what's really important to us. Number two, who am I trying to please? What did Paul say in Galatians 1:10? Yeah. Who am I trying to please? Am I trying to please God or man? If I'm trying to please men, I cannot be the servant of Jesus Christ. Okay? I just can't be. Who am I trying to please? Now, you heard about the young fellow that got married and started preaching. He said he started out trying to please three. His wife, the congregation, and the Lord. And he said he'd been married about a week. And gave up on trying to please his wife. He had preached about 2 weeks and gave up on trying to please the congregation. He guessed he would just stick with trying to please the Lord. I would hope that pleasing the Lord pleases my wife. And I would hope pleasing the Lord would please the congregation. But my priority must be pleasing the Lord. Now, I've never believed in being just an independent preacher removed from the congregation and the authority of the elders, but I have never worked for a church. I work for the Lord. I work with congregations. And I work under the oversight of elders. But I think sometimes we get the idea, I work for elders. I work for elders. I had a man who was an elder tell me that preachers were nothing but hired hands. Do you know what I know about the preachers that went through that congregation like through a revolving door? Wonder why they didn't stay with an elder with that kind of an attitude? Well, I wouldn't stay there either, would you? We work for the Lord, all of us. We work in congregations with one another. We work under the authority of elders. Who do we work for? The Lord. And who do we always want to try to please? Above everything.
The Lord.
The Lord. I mean, that's our goal. I want to please the Lord in everything I do. Hope that pleases my elders. It ought to.
If we're not careful, however, and it's happening in some of your smaller congregations within the Lord's church, they're viewing it as though, hey, we're paying this guy to do his job.
Oh, I know.
So it's his job, not ours.
I know that. I'm aware of that. I'm aware of that. We argue against the pastor system and then practice it, especially in small congregations. And it's a shame. And we just got to fight against that. And I think some preachers enjoy that. I never have. I don't want that. Who am I trying to please? Can we look at people and figure out who it is they're trying to please from appearances, from what goes on? Generally speaking, we can. Third question. What am I going to do about what I know to do? Matthew 23:3. Matthew 23 is a scorcher anyway. What's the Lord say?
therefore, all that they tell you, do and observe, but do not do according to their deeds.
Mm-hmm.
For they say things and do not do them.
That's right. Who's he talking about?
Pharisees.
Pharisees, religious leaders. They would say one thing and do another. He said, you can do what they say because they say the right things. Just don't do what they do because they say and do not. What am I going to do about what I know to do? I think that's a hard question. Because sometimes we know very well what we ought to do. We just don't get around to doing it. Can't muster the strength or whatever it takes to do it. Maybe unpopular to do it. What am I going to do about what I know to do? I'll give you, for instance, had a mother come to me in a congregation. We had an educational committee. We'd have an educational director, but we had an educational committee made up of the heads of the various departments. And since I was in charge of the adult classes, I was on that educational committee. And so she came to me and said, we've got a problem in the class my boys are in. I said, well, what's the problem? And she said, well, the teacher, if she comes at all for worship, she comes on Sunday morning. She was teaching on Sunday morning. Says, but sometimes she will come and teach her class and then leave. And my boys have asked me, why Miss So-and-so does that? And I said, we've got a problem. So we called her in. And one of the elders was on the teacher's committee, and he and I called her in and talked to her. And she said, well, I knew it was going to come to this. Said, I really ought to do better, and I know it. But I'm awful busy, and I just don't believe I can do any better than I'm doing right now. And if you want to replace me as a teacher, it'll be okay. And I said, well, I'm sorry, but you've left us, I don't think, any alternative. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Remember, as important as what you say in a classroom is what you are. Now, what if she said that the church was important? What was she doing by her example? Was showing that it wasn't. So we said, okay, you're relieved of your class. It evidently wasn't all right because next week they transferred to another congregation. And they took him in. She knew. I want to know, what are you going to do about what you know to do? You can only do as well as you know to do. But once you know, what are you going to do about that? Are you going to say, I'm going to act accordingly? Were you going to say something? Did I interrupt?
I'm going to say that's what you do.
That's exactly what you do. So, to find out if we're a person, if we're people of character and integrity, we say, what's really important to me? Who am I trying to please? And what am I going to do about what I know to do? Now, that brings us to some specifics. What does character and integrity demand of us in a practical way down to earth? I think congregations ought to have requirements for teachers that are stated, everybody knows what they are, and they're enforced. Now, I don't mean without bending. I mean, we have to understand there are cases, there are situations, and we have to deal with people as people. But I think we have a right to expect a certain level of attitude and behavior out of people who are going to teach in our classes. Do you agree? I think we have to be reasonable. Now, here's a little tidbit that I found works very well. Instead of going in and saying, these are our requirements, get your teachers together and ask the teachers to draw up what the qualifications and requirements are. You know what will happen? What would you guess would happen? Most of the people here are from the Flatwoods congregation. What would happen at Flatwoods if you got all your teachers together and said, we are looking for some reasonable requirements for our teachers, qualifications? What do you think they would come up with? They'd come up with good qualifications. Yeah, they wouldn't say, well, you wouldn't have to attend services, and you wouldn't have to know your lesson, and you wouldn't have to... They wouldn't say that, would they?
No.
What's the advantage of letting them come up with the requirements?
They feel that they are responsible for what's going to be done.
Okay. It's a matter of ownership. It's a matter of involvement. It's a matter of transparency. It was not decided behind closed doors and dropped down on their heads. They had a part to play in the setting of the requirements. So you say, that's a good set.
9 times out of 10, it might be better than what you would set for yourself.
It might be. It might even be higher than you would set if you were setting them. Here are reasonable ones that our people have come up with. In places where I've been. Number one, faithfulness. 2 Timothy 2:2, you're going to get... I started to say tired of that verse, but I hope not tired of it. It's just, I hope you'll know it. The things which thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. Do we have a right to expect our teachers to be faithful?
Yes.
What's it mean? How do we normally decide that?
Attendance,
yeah. When say, does Brother So-and-so go to church over where you go? Yeah. Is he faithful? What does somebody mean when they ask that? Does he show up when the doors are open? Now, there is a faithfulness in attendance. But does that tell the story?
No.
No. It tells a part of the story. But it doesn't tell the whole story. I've known people who were there every time the doors were open who were just really scallywags. You know what I mean? They just really were. It doesn't tell the whole story. So what areas must we demand that our teachers are faithful in? Faithfulness and attendance. What else?
Knowledge.
Phrase that another way. Because I don't know how you...
would, knowledge of God's Word.
I'm going to say faithful to the Word. Okay? Do we have a right to expect that?
Yes.
Faithful to the Word. Here's another story, Mark. You'll not believe this one. They had a boy, young man, who was a freshman in college, which meant, you know, he knew everything. And I wasn't at this congregation. The elders were telling me about it. He was an elder's son. And he was teaching the teenage class. And how the thing came to light, somebody went into the room where he'd been teaching and there were pictures of male and female genitalia on the board. He felt that it was his responsibility to teach the teenagers about boys and girls. Now, what would you think about a class like that?
Did you say he was a sophomore in...
He was a freshman.
Freshman in college.
Uh-huh. At WVU, but don't hold that against him.
Well,
the school had nothing to do with it.
No, I just don't know how he got in that position. I mean, he wasn't that much older than
you're right. Were. You're right. You're right. It was crazy all around.
Yeah. I don't feel it was his responsibility.
It was not his responsibility.
That's the parents' responsibility.
What should he have been trying to teach? Something from the Bible, the Word of God. I wrote a bulletin article one time entitled, "We Don't Call It Bible School for Nothing." If we're going to call it Bible school, guess what we ought to study?
Bible.
The Bible. We really ought to call it, we ought to study the Bible. In all classes. Now, I have nothing wrong with crafts, games, connect the dots, as long as they help us teach something from the Bible. Otherwise, they have no right to exist. They don't stand on their own. Okay? It's like illustrations in a sermon. Illustrations have no right to exist other than if they illustrate a point. They have no independent standing. It's not like, well, I just thought before I started I'd tell you this joke I heard last week. I mean, that's crazy. That has no independent standing. If it relates to a point, you might use that. So we want people who are faithful to the Word. Go teach the Bible what the Bible says. And they're not going to say, the Bible says, but. They're going to say, the Bible says so. That's the way it is. So we want them faithful to the Word. What else do we want them faithful to?
faithful in their living.
Yeah. Faithful in their living. That's right. We want to know that this is a person who lives what he professes. Now, let's go back to faithful. Does that mean perfect? I think a person may sometime lose his temper. I want to know if that's characteristic of him or not. If he's known as a person who can't control his temper, I don't believe he's faithful and ought to be put in the classroom, because he's likely to lose his temper someday in the classroom, and that's really going to be a mess. Now, if it's just out of character and nobody expected that and you don't expect that ever happen again, I think that's another matter. I use the example of husbands to explain the difference between perfect and faithful. And I think you immediately get the point, don't you? If you ask my wife if I'm a perfect husband, you'll have to give her a moment or two to recover. Because she'll be laughing uncontrollably. And it's, you've got to be kidding, Tom Miller. If you ask her if I'm a faithful husband without skipping a beat, she'll say absolutely. There's a big difference, isn't there? And if there is in husbands, the same thing is true in regard to Christians. But we want somebody who's faithful, steadfast, in regard to their Christian living. So we want a person who's faithful in all aspects of living for the Lord. Okay? Does that make sense? What about sincerity? Have you ever heard of the imposter phenomenon? Mm-hmm. Somebody tell me what the imposter phenomenon is. There's a whole book called the imposter phenomenon. You know what it is?
You have a facade all the time.
Yeah, you have a facade all the time. You get to living such a way that you get to believing that's you. I don't want anybody faking anything in a Bible class. I want people in Bible classes to be genuine. What's some of the things that we think we have to... What's part of our imposter persona as Bible class teachers, we think? First of all, we have to know everything. Yeah. And if we don't know, we'll make it up, you know. Yeah. Or we will just talk until somebody says, well, okay, I didn't understand that, but he must really be smart. You know, it's like when somebody dies and you get that big question, why did that happen? And we think, well, since you ask, it has to do with the fall of man in the garden and sin entered the world. And we go into this big theological discourse, and I don't know why. I'm not going to try to fake anybody out. I just don't know. People, we talked about Job a moment ago, said, well, if you just read Job, you'd understand the problem of evil and suffering. No, you won't. You know what God finally told Job in the theophany at the end of the book? I'm God and you're not. Trust me. God never told Job the reason for evil and suffering, did he? He just said, Job, trust me. I don't remember asking you when I was making the world. I don't need your advice now. Didn't explain things to him. And Job said, I was stupid. I was just really stupid. You're right, God. So I can't explain all the mysteries of life and death. I just don't know. But that's a part of the phenomenon. What's another part of the imposter phenomenon? That we have to talk a certain way. We have to use a certain vocabulary.
Sometimes preparing lessons, I think, you know, if I can just say this a certain way, I'll lock this person's heart and
yeah.
They'll obey.
Yeah.
Really not that at all.
Yeah. When I was growing up, we aped older preachers, you know. if they said a certain thing, Brother Butterfield, Tom Butterfield, you say, if you can't understand that, just go home and treat your wife right and it'll be okay. His jowls would just shake. And so you thought, and he'd say, now if you don't agree with that, just rustle your foot and I'll give you the floor. You know, I always wondered what would happen if somebody would just do that. And we thought, well, we have to do that. You just have to say things a certain way, or talk a certain way, or use a certain language, or dress a certain way. I think we have to be who we are. We have to be genuine. I like people who are what they are, and you know what they are, and you take them that way. Now, that's no cover up for being something less than we ought to be. But I don't like somebody who's faking it. I don't like somebody who puts on their face and goes to church and we just bump shells. I like people who are real, don't you?
Yes.
I think Bible class teachers ought to be real people. What about studiousness? Do we have a right to expect that our teachers know their lesson?
Yes.
Not only the facts, but the application. Now, when I was in school, in Bible school, you know what we talked about all the time? Facts. You remember our workbooks? Yes, no, true, false, fill in the blanks. Remember those? What do you have for question number two? True. Well, that's right. Everybody else agree? Okay, what do you got for number three? And we just learned fact after fact after fact. Now, do you know where education has gone?
The other way.
The other way. We talk about application. Johnny and Susie were going down the street, and they found a $20 bill in front of Mrs. Smith's house. Oh, what shall they do? Miss Smith's a very poor widow. Should they knock on the door and ask her if they had lost it, or should they head to the ice cream stand? I was using that illustration in a teacher's workshop in Kentucky and in Paintsville, and the guy spoke up and said, send them to the ice cream shop. I said, why? He said, I own it. I said, do you have chocolate peanut butter? He said, yes. I said, I'll be right over after this thing is over. And I got there and there was this big quart of chocolate peanut butter ice cream, so he's my best friend, new friend now. But we went from facts to application. Why does it have to be one or the other? Now, I'll admit that facts can be pretty cold, can't they?
Yeah.
But if you don't have the facts, how do you know to make the application?
You don't.
Application's based upon facts, you know. So I don't want an either or. I want my teachers to know the facts, but I want them to know how that applies. I think the failures of preachers is we get to the so what point and we never tell people so what. We just give them a lot of information. A lot of sermons are like a dump truck backing up. You know, beep, 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 beep. And then it goes up and all this stuff comes out and the people are sitting out there in the pew going, you're burying me under all this stuff. What am I supposed to do with it? Well, we never get around to telling them what to do because we assume they'll figure it out. A lot of people don't do the hard work to figure it out. So let's give them some facts and let's say, okay, here's what I want you to do with that. Here's the application. I preach on prayer. I want you to pray. I want to tell you that you need to pray. I want you to pray morning, noon, and night. I want you to pray for these people, these situations. I want to tell you what to do with this sermon. Yes, Mark?
I don't remember who it was, but I was reading some things about restoration preachers. And there was an older preacher that was teaching a younger one. A couple of his lessons that he learned, he kind of applied it to being like fish.
Yeah. You know,
like one had too much application. He said, the tail's too long on that one, you better throw it back. You know, and the other one had too much information.
Yeah.
He said, the nose is too big on that one.
Yeah.
So you got to have just the right amount of meat in the middle and a good tail. And
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's absolutely right. So, studiousness to know both the facts and the application. Okay? What about truthfulness? Do we expect our teachers to be truthful? In life, even.
Yes.
Which means no hypocrisy. You know, you can live a lie as much as you can tell a lie. Now, we're all going to fail. Somebody says a hypocrite is somebody who makes a mistake. No, it's not. If that's true, we're all hypocrites. It came from the stage, as you well know, where actors would wear two different faces. Now, they might be a woman in Act 1 and a man in Act 2. Just change the face and the costume. It's pretense. It's pretending to be something you aren't. And so I want a person who is absolutely truthful to be a teacher. What about the good example? We've talked about that. Romans 2, 21 through 24. There are some rhetorical questions asked. You who say that you ought not do this, do you do it? And his point was, yeah, you do. If you're going to say one thing, then do what you say. And a positive attitude. I want somebody who wants to be there. I've told you before, I don't believe in twisting anybody's arm to get them to do anything. Because if you have to twist their arm to get them started, you have to twist their arm to keep them going. And they're going to be in misery, and they're not going to do a good job. If somebody says, oh, I guess I'll go if you can't get anybody else. No, you won't. No, you won't. I want people who go, with some fear and trepidation perhaps, but I want people to go who say, I'm excited about being a teacher in this program. I want to be here. I'm excited about being here. When Jody and I go and do teachers' workshops, I always know who the really great teachers in that congregation are. They're the ones that come up to us and say, you want to come see my classroom? I teach down here. I got the sweetest little kids. Look, I got their pictures up there. I got the door all decorated for fall. And you know, I love this class. And you know what we know immediately? That's a good teacher. That's a teacher that wants to be there, that loves teaching, and will do a good job. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Ask a question.
Yeah, ask away.
We talked several times about what people are.
Yeah.
But how much time do you think, say, newcomers in the congregation, or right now for us, I mean, which is looking for another minister, how do you know who that person is? Because some of that, it takes time.
Yeah, it does.
And I find not only in one situation, but in the church, that when you ask for recommendations, or any more, people are real hesitant to give you the truth. They'll hedge on. But what's been your experience? Either, say, a newcomer to the congregation, say a couple comes in, they place membership. How long do you wait before you put them in a teaching role?
I know at Carnes, our insurance demanded we wait 6 months. Yes, because of problems that some churches were having with abuse. And they said, you cannot have a teacher in your program who hasn't been here 6 months. And the reason they said that is because that behavior generally manifests itself within 6 months in a new location. So we just simply said to people, it has to be 6 months. Plus, we required that they go through a course.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would guess that under most circumstances, when they came in, we asked them, have you taught before? Where did you teach? And we called those places. Brother, sister, so-and-so say they taught in your congregation. Oh, yes, boy, they were great. We were so sorry to lose them. Okay, that gave you a leg up. A lot of it, Mark, had to do with what we knew about the people as to how soon. But no sooner than 6 months at all. And that was insurance requirement. I think we have to be careful. Because I know churches, we're so desperate to get teachers that sometimes we just put people in who are ill-prepared to teach and shouldn't be teaching. And that gets us into some real messes, I think. Anybody else? Questions or observations? The teacher's evaluation is on page 12. And we ask our teachers to evaluate yourself. We gave this to them and said, be honest. Do you pray for yourself in the class? Do you make adequate preparation? Do you have everything organized before the students get there? Do you cheerfully greet? We had a 15-minute rule. You had to be, unless something terrible happened, you had to be at your class door 15 minutes before class time. I don't think any kid ought to ever arrive at a door of a classroom and it's dark. And you talk about a lawsuit. All you need is for a couple of kids to get in a classroom without any supervision. And one of them get hurt. And so we said, teachers, either you or your assistant needs to be at the door to receive the students 15 minutes before class time. We had to say, well, I won't teach then. Okay, it's fine. Treat each student lovingly and fairly. Keep the needs of each student in mind. Promptly contact those who are absent. Visit in the homes of regular students and visitors. Set a good example and seek to improve my ability. And so we ask our teachers, how do you do on this? We had regular teachers meetings and we just went over things like this. I think that people will, at first there'll be all kinds of grumbling. Really? Because we're just not used to this, are we? What are we used to?
Somebody come and say, do you want to teach?
Yeah, you want to teach? Yeah, go. And so people just get real upset when we talk about requirements and qualifications and training. But after a while they say, hey, y'all are serious about this here, aren't you? I want to be a part of this. We did a survey when I was at Carnes of what are the things that most impressed you about this congregation and made you decide that you wanted to place your membership here. This was people transferred in. And what would you think the number one thing would normally be in a church?
I'd like to minister.
Yeah. Was not on the list. And we had a good preacher. Number one was the Bible classes. And number two was the singing. We had really great singing. And that was the two top things. I just thought that was amazing. And since I was helping with the educational program, I thought was particularly gratified that the number one was the Bible class. They said, we have never been any place where we have had the quality and the quantity of Bible classes that we have here, the opportunities to study. I think you can build a congregation that way. Okay? Mark's going to talk about the four no's, K-N-O-W-S, of teaching next week. Thank you, folks. I appreciate it very much. You could, it's flung here. You're going to stick it in my heart, right? Ah! I didn't know what to push there.